4 o'clock.
Blog Talk Radio.
On Point with your co-hosts, me, Don Allen, and Mr. Ron Edwards. Mr. Edwards in Studio B, broadcasting live from the Macintosh Studios. How are you doing today, Mr. Edwards?
Fine, Mr. Allen. Good to have you back with us after your domestic assignment.
Yes, yes.
How's it going? I understand we have Randy First, senior correspondent or senior writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. So let's move into that. Mr. First, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Pleasure. Good to have you with me. On Wednesday, the Star Tribune front page, above the fold, in fact, under your byline, writes a piece entitled Beyond the Great Recession, Our Black-White Jobless Gap, but the key headline was Worst in the Nation. And I have to tell you, Mr. First, powerful article. I've received a lot of calls from around the country. Folks saying, tell us it ain't true kind of thing, and that's kind of a pun and a joke. But, Randy, first of all, how long have you been a reporter for the Star Tribune?
I've been a reporter there for 38 years.
My God, Randy, that's a long time. That gives you some bragging rights, if you will. Give us your general take. I know this is a part of a series, an exclusive series, by the way, initiated by the Trib, talking about Beyond the Great Recession. But what was it that that piqued your interest and kind of motivated you to decide to take this on?
Well, it was pretty obvious that there was a serious problem here. There have been there's been information in the news over the last year about the difficulty of black workers finding jobs here in the Twin Cities, an item here, an item there. We know, of course, that we're facing the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. And historically, unemployment has been higher for blacks than it has been for whites nationwide. And in downturns, generally speaking, minorities are the hardest hit. So I began poking around and found some data that included some reports based on an examination of unemployment statistics back in 2009 that set the Twin Cities at having the worst disparity in unemployment between blacks and whites in the country. So I got interested that way, and then I started doing some more probing.
You did something rather interesting, not necessarily unprecedented, but certainly unique in general media reporting. And that is, you went out and in the tradition of the old days of Vietnam, if you will, you talked to the folks that have boots on the ground. You didn't go out and talk to anyone per se that was sitting in a comfortable office enjoying a comfortable day and experiencing all the comfortable parts of life. You went out and talked to people who were directly being affected by what's going on, this unfortunate pattern that's happening in our city. How did you decide, Randy, that was an approach you wanted to use as opposed to the safe approach?
Well, I don't know. It's just natural for me. I mean, that's kind of the way you do it. You want to find people. You want to get a sense of what they're going through. Even as you're trying to probe the numbers. So it's kind of a basic journalistic approach, I think. Right?
Were you surprised, though, as you indicate, there have been a number of studies. In fact, one of the most recent as it pertains to a red flag in our estimation here on Point was a study done by a young research, African-American research, female African-American researcher at the University of Minnesota in collaboration with former Judge LeJune Lang in 2007, which was presented to the Minneapolis City Council and just, you know, apparently put in a drawer somewhere. But were you yourself, as a 38-year veteran of journalism with the Star Tribune and in this city, were you surprised by the numbers?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I was surprised by a couple of things. One, the numbers from 2009, but the state Department of Employment, a researcher there, their chief researcher, was able to figure out the numbers right up through January 2011, and it showed the same disparity, that is, the worst disparity between white jobless rates and black jobless rates in the nation. And when you looked at his data, which go back to 2002, you actually see this serious widening of disparity since 2004. In other words, this has been going on for 7 years. 7 years in which the unemployment disparity between blacks and whites is triple. The black unemployment rate is triple that of whites. Nationally, you know, it's bad. It's double. And that's been going on for decades or close to it. But it's been at triple the rate since 2004. And when I was completing the report, out came some national numbers from U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics for all of 2010, the latest figures. And the latest figures, which have not yet, as far as I can see on the question of black and white, been aired nationally, but I was able to examine that for every state in the country. And what do you know? For the state of Minnesota in 2010, biggest disparity in the country. In other words, it's been going on for a while. It is persistent and it is bad.
On that particular note, let's explore that a little bit. And I also would want to talk with you a little bit about another piece of information that was very riveting, and that is the whole pattern of incarceration and what it does to an employment application or a job application. I'm puzzled, though, because with this data, and by the way, an excellent chart in the paper, in this story, you showed a graphic, and what you've just said and what you've just detailed is reflected in this graphic and talks in terms of persistent problem. But in October of last year, a very prestigious research firm with headquarters in New York, regional headquarters around the country, in this case, the regional headquarters in Austin, Texas. This firm, NERC, was commissioned and retained by the city of Minneapolis at a cost of $500,000 of taxpayers' money to do a study, which actually took 5 years. The report came out on the 21st and 22nd of October, and it reflected many of the things that you went into in deep detail. Only problem is there, and my colleague, Mr. Allen, was at this so-called public hearing. When it came time for a discussion of that disparity study, just as it happened in 2007, city officialdom, if you will, turned their back on it. And, in fact, there was never any discussion about the significant disparity and the reflections including the fact, as an example, the city of Minneapolis, though they say that they monitor, as an example, contracts and jobs as it pertains to the awarding of contracts by the city of Minneapolis, no testimony was allowed. Is this an indication that this is an elephant in the room that we don't want to talk about?
Well, I haven't covered that issue in the city of Minneapolis and those city politics. So I really
Are you surprised by that, the lack of attentiveness, if you will, or commitment to at least probe?
What surprises me is that, actually, I've been surprised by the reaction to this story. There's been a fair amount of discussion of it in various quarters, and I'm pleased that it's getting that. I'm pleased that we got the story in the paper, because clearly this has been something that's been going on for years, and I'm, kind of surprised that this is the first time that it's, that we've had this kind of breakout information, in the sense that is, really exploded on the front pages. This has been a problem, as we could tell here, for a long time. And I'm just gratified that finally, maybe, it will kickstart some thinking over the issue.
Let me ask you, were you shocked? If not, why not? With respect to the data about the issue of incarceration, criminal records, and et cetera, how did you decide to probe that?
Well, understand, I know less about the incarceration facet than about the general unemployment data. I haven't dug as deeply into that. Nonetheless, when I was interviewing experts, and also as well as interviewing people out at unemployment offices who were incarcerated, and describing to me how tough it was to get a job, and interviewing some of the experts, they were saying, incarceration is an important factor in people not getting jobs. And like you say, I've been a reporter for a long time, and I've covered different sorts of things, and I know darn well that it's terribly hard for anybody getting out of prison to get a job, get decent housing, get a job, and so forth. I did look at some statistics, and again, I am not an expert in this area, but the statistics indicated that a couple of things. One was that while at one point Minnesota may have had one of the worst or close to the worst percentage of blacks who were imprisoned, I think that goes back to around 1994. That number has dropped significantly, according to the data that I read. In other words, not as many blacks in prison. However, Another figure shows that people who are in jail, that is people who are in prison are in prison for a year or more, whereas if you're in jail, it's less than a year. That the numbers of blacks in jail seems to have gone up. And so overall, the incarceration rates may be higher. Overall, are quite high. Overall, the arrest rates may be significantly high. One of the things that goes on here and elsewhere is some concern raised that in minor drug arrests like marijuana and that sorts of thing can compare to that more heavy duty drugs. There's more blacks arrested. By a significant number, just the inner city stuff, whereas the dude out in the burbs just goes.
Okay, on that particular point, before continued transparency. That's an interesting point.
I'm just saying that when let me just finish one point, and that
okay.
is when somebody walks in for a job.
Mm-hmm.
whether it's a prison job or whether they have a prison record or a minor infraction. It's on their record, and there may be a lot more of those on the record for black people overall than for whites, which may be a factor.
Right, and certainly we can appreciate that in the African American community. But it's interesting that you talked in terms of that reflection, because I can well remember when at that time Hennepin County sitting judge, who had a very bright future in front of her, made those same kind of analysis. Her name was Judge Pam Alexander.
Pam Alexander.
Unfortunately, yeah. those examples and her advocacy, if you will, cost her a federal judgeship. And
right.
Ultimately, as you and I know, in the last year and a half, she left the district court bench, understanding that she would never be appointed or escalated on the bench. Let me do this, Mr. First. There was a specific part in this, and I'd like to get your response to what kind of reflections you've had made to you since Wednesday. The state's black population is 5 years younger on average than the black population nationally, and unemployment is higher among younger people. White Twin Cityans are more educated than counterparts in most other metro areas, while black Twin Cityans are somewhat less educated than blacks elsewhere. Some experts say the employment gap may be fueled in part by another disparity. Fewer white Minnesotans have criminal records than whites nationally, while the opposite is true for black Minnesotans. The disparity between blacks and whites on that score is four times higher in the state than for the country as a whole. Did that startle you, sir?
Sure.
That particular
absolutely.
Reflection, four times, with a population that is only about the African-American population in this state is maybe at about 3% at best?
Oh, sure. Of course it did.
Okay. You said earlier that you've been pleasantly surprised on one hand about the response, but have you been unpleasantly surprised by some comments that are made by some folks who felt that there was a justification for this gap and these disparities?
Well, you know, I've gotten a lot of calls from this publishing this story. Some were really positive, thought this is a great thing, and then there were a lot of people that basically said things sort of along the lines, well, what do you expect? There are more of these people in prison. You expect that there's going to be higher unemployment, and you know, and even harsher remarks. So,
right. But on that point, let me then ask you that, because you did an excellent job of pointing out, and it's obvious it was in the back of your mind, that also, and this is part of what the disparity study that came out in October that the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis paid $500,000 for, said it really didn't make any difference, because at a comparable level, African Americans who had the same equivalency of education and et cetera were still less able or would be presented less of an opportunity to be hired for a job with a white who had less academic achievement and et cetera. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, that was in my story. Yeah,
right. That's right.
I have to say that it didn't surprise me, you know, given the state of the conditions here. Yeah.
I want to ask you about one more, and then we're certainly going to let you go. We appreciate the time you're taking. We know this is a kind of an off day. I was telling my colleague, Mr. Allen, that the story. Because here was a guy in this particular story that must have been doing all the right things, and it certainly is a rebuttal to those who would say to you, well, what do you expect? You know, these people are criminal and of the criminal element, or they're poorly educated, et cetera. You had a man in here by the name of Mason, and for 11 years, And I did notice, Randy, that you made sure that you did not indicate the company that he worked for. But for 11 years, he worked apparently as a good employee for a local armored car company. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he was jettisoned. Is there anything that troubled you as a reporter, 38-year veteran, about that particular pattern? And did you find more of those patterns in your search, in your soul journey, if you will?
I'm trying to remember, as you can tell, there were a lot of interviews in that article, and all the people that we interviewed were not in that article. And my recollection of this particular individual was that he said that he lost his job because he had a disability that made it impossible for him to hold a license to drive a truck, a heavyweight truck, in an armored car business. He further said that even though he couldn't get such a license, he didn't actually drive the truck.
Anyway, right.
Nonetheless, he got laid off, it was catch-22 things.
But don't we have laws in this state, in this nation, about protecting the rights of those who have disabilities? 11 years that he had this disability, and obviously, as you pointed out, he was doing something other than driving the truck for 11 years that he appeared to be an employee in good standing, yet all of a sudden the disability came into play. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe so. Maybe if he took it to a disability lawyer, maybe he could build a case. I don't know. Like I said, I interviewed an awful lot of people, and we could try to track his case back, but, you know, there were a lot of stories.
All right.
Yeah.
Mr. Allen, we've spent a lot of time, excellent time with Mr. Frey. Any question you have, Mr. Allen?
Yeah, I just have one quick question. You know, Mr. First, on June 9th, 2010, a story authored by Molly Young, the title was Twin Cities Had the Widest Jobless Gap by Race. My question to you would be, what happened between June 2010 and then your story you put out this Wednesday, Our Black White Jobless Gap Worse Than the Nation, that this one was so much more powerful than the one that was done last year on June 9th.
I'm not sure. I think that story appeared on the business page. I think it was a short account, maybe 10 to 12 inches.
Right.
I think the individual may be an intern. It was probably a spot story based on a national wire story that came out after this Economic Policy Institute issued its report, showing it was on 18 selected cities, and if you read through the report down there, I think on page 5 or 6, it mentions the Minneapolis aspect. So that, you know, it's one of those things where a newspaper did a quick hit. Put it on the business page. Again, I don't work for the business page, but I assume that's what happened. Things move on, and then another report, i.e. me, raises the idea with my supervisor, Larry Oakes, about digging into the unemployment and into black unemployment. He says, go for it, so we start some work on it.
Okay. All right, Mr. First, I want to thank you again on this end, on point. Mr. Allen and myself, we're both saying we think it's an excellent article.
Yes.
And it is a reflection of a longstanding concern within the African-American community about discrimination and disparity. Again, I want to thank you, and the best. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks. A pleasure to be on. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Allen, wow. Interesting reflections by the 38-year veteran of that paper. Excellent question by you and us here on Point. I mean, really, what happened from June 9th until this happened, because also in between we had the disparity study of October 21st and 22nd,
yeah,
in which Velma Corvell and the city council declined to allow testimony on the, was it the 2nd of March, on this particular matter. And then even at an informational hearing they had that I understand you and some others attended at the Venice Public Library just last week, stayed as far away as they possibly could from talking in terms of disparity. And, you know, and I call our attention to the front page of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, a paper which both you and I are familiar with, in which there was some reflection, but nothing compared to what Mr. First laid out, what Ms. Young laid out, and, of course, what was being laid out by others of us. And, of course, I have to say that we have reflected on this as a columnist for the Spokesman Recorder for the last 5 or 6 years.
yes, we have.
Yes, but sometimes we understand what it is that, you know, finally gets the general masses riled up. You have any reflections, Mr. Allen, as we've listened to this excellent interview with Mr. First?
Well, yes. You know, Mr. Edwards, I've been looking at this, like you said, for the last 30, 35, 40 years, me the last, you know. we've been saying this very out loud, very to the point where it's gotten annoying for folks.
Yes, it has.
But it doesn't seem, what really is peculiar to me, that, and I can go back over some historical data. January 5th, we broke the story here on Point about City Inc. closing.
Yes,
and
sir.
They said, oh, you guys are lying. That's not real. You need to check your facts. A week and a half later, the Star Tribune has it on their in their paper. Now all of a sudden it's legitimate. So I don't know, you know, what it is or how we're to get, drive these points across to these people that there's some serious disparities. I mean, even we just had Mr. First on. You know, do I have to be a zombie in Minneapolis to get $165,000? Has the story he wrote on August 23rd, 2010, the settlement with the city and the zombies that were walking in a parade? I mean, what's happening here? You know, our whole political infrastructure and the black, the white, the achievement gap, the unemployment. But yet, Mr. Edwards, if you notice, there's a steady stream of money going to a few people.
Same few. That's correct. That's
the
correct.
The same few all the time. Mm. Okay. So
let me ask this question of ourselves. We're, you know, here. And by the way, we haven't given the phone number. Mr. Allen, the phones are open. Last week was a special foreign affairs program, and with respect to some technical problem, we didn't open the phone lines. The phone lines are clearly open this afternoon. But why has the black legislative leadership taken this matter up in the halls of the state capitol? Now, we all know there's going to be a big economic development piece this coming Wednesday with Governor Mark Dayton. He'll come in for about an hour and a half and, I guess, chit-chat about the economic problems. But our black legislative caucus, now comprised of 4 African-Americans, 1 state senator, and 3 state legislators, have certainly had ample opportunity. And the reason I ask this is that for the last number of months, this program, On Point, has talked about our concern and disappointment with the Council on Black Minnesotans. Again, the Spokesman Recorder ran a 2-part series by Charles Holman over the last couple of weeks. And Lester Collins, the longtime, over 20-some years, executive director of the Council on Black Minnesotans, has talked about a multiplicity of things. But just as they don't talk about, you know, police brutality and misconduct and tobacco and things like that, did I miss something? Maybe I was on assignment and away on another planet. The Council on Black Minnesotans spoke on any aspect of these items? Let's just start with June 9th. I mean, we'll try to be fair-minded. As Mr. First pointed out, a brief kind of overview, quick narrative of a report that identified Minneapolis as the worst offender. Notice the word offender,
yes,
in America as it pertains to the gap between black and white hiring. And then the disparity study of October 21st, 23rd that took 5 years to do. And then any other point in time up to today. Did I miss a press conference and a public hearing by the Council on Black Minnesotans to address this?
Mr. Edwards, you did not miss a public hearing by the Council on Black Minnesotans at all whatsoever. They have not touched any of these type topics ever.
Okay.
Period.
Isn't that a part of there? And I know we did it a couple times over the last 45 to 50 days. Isn't that a part of their legislative mandate and mission statement?
Yes. Their mandate, Mr. Edwards, is to significantly improve the atmosphere, if you will, or lives and activities of black Minnesotans, which includes reporting to the state legislators about what's going on here in the Twin Cities and
okay.
the black community.
Well, here's the reason I raised the question, Mr. Allen. I know that they're still trying to plan for their great event on Wednesday, and they're going to have the governor, but the governor's bringing his commissioners and et cetera. You know, they need to be happy that Mark Dayton is, quote-unquote, a liberal Democrat, because if I, you know, was Mark Dayton and one of the so-called leaders got up in the meeting on next Wednesday pontificating and talking about the problems, if I was Governor Mark Dayton, I'd have to ask the question of us in the black community, how long have y'all known about it? And what have
exactly.
you done about it?
Exactly.
Now, am I off base here or what?
No, you're right on base. And Mr. Edwards, we do have a caller standing by.
Oh, let's pick it up. Let's do it.
Hello, you're live on the air, man. Who's calling?
Hey, what's going on, Brother Allen, Mr. Edwards? I'm sitting back
listening
to y'all.
What's going on, man? How you doing? What you got for it? What's up?
All right, no, I was listening to the conversation. That was deep. You hitting a lot of issues there. But I was calling just to encourage y'all to keep doing. I know you've been doing this a long time, Ron, and because Randy first put something in the Sign Trib, I guess that wakes everybody up to stuff that's been said 20 or 30 years ago, but the word couldn't get out. They had so many gatekeepers keeping that information down, and look what you're talking about, the Council on Black Minnesota. It was pretty deep. I was sitting there listening. That was good stuff of what they should have been doing, so it shouldn't be a shock. But people like yourself that has been saying this all the time, it's just due time. I think it's just due time. So although we wanted to tell Randy, I'm surprised he was able to get it through. But I think it was so bad, the things that has gotten so bad, and we, like you said, we the worst in the nation. And I think you said Minneapolis, we've been fighting this a long time, Ron. So it's just due for people like yourself that's been advocating for on behalf of the African American kids for it to finally come out. Too bad it got to come out in the white paper before we take notice.
All right.
I just want to tell you thanks and keep doing what you're doing. We'll get Randy a little plug for getting it out there, but it's a lot of more stuff that's probably going to be coming out that's already been said, but now they're just identifying and corroborating what you and some others have said,
you. All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. All right. All right.
Okay. I appreciate y'all. Keep doing what you're doing, man.
All right. All right. Al Flowers, Mr. Allen, longtime community activist, and one who, I mean, one that, as I understand it, has really been raising some serious questions in the planning sessions as it pertains to this coming together in seance with Governor Mark Dayton. Appears Ms. Flowers has been basically the only one, though I understand this morning he was possibly joined by Troy Parker, example, talking about that there needs to be really a plan and some solutions. You know, solutions are always important. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Solutions are just beyond, you know, putting some some detergent in the water and washing some dishes. Oops.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Don. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, Mr. Edwards, on that note, you know, I'm glad Mr. Flowers called because I attended one of the planning meeting breakfast this morning at New Salem Baptist Church. And
Okay.
Yeah, and State Representative Bobby Joe Champion.
I cannot look at this guy without laughing.
Was not there. he was not there. And
wait a minute, I'm a little confused down now. We want to be transparent and as on front. As Mr. Flowers has pointed out and seems to be a lonely voice out there on this, as a member of the planning committee, this is supposed to be Bobby Joe and Jeff Hayden, and this is supposed to be their thing from that end, and Reverend Jerry McAfee is supposed to be, you know, bringing the community together. Now, wait a minute, you said they had a breakfast meeting this morning at Reverend McAfee's church?
Yes,
and all four of the state representatives weren't there?
No, they weren't there. Now, let me position.
Was there a special session of the legislature this morning, or what?
Yeah, they must have, you know, legislated somewhere. But the thing is, here's what worries me. I'm listening to Reverend McAfee. Okay, he has a plan. Okay, I'm gonna give him. He has a plan. I'm gonna give him that 100%.
Okay.
Charlie Parker has a plan.
Okay.
Al Flowers has a plan.
Okay.
But you got at the table, you got Lester Collins from the Council on Black Minnesota.
Oh, Lester Collins was there this morning? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There, you got Bill English, formerly with City Inc., was at the table. You had Natalie Lee Johnson, who was with the Council on Black Minnesotans. And you had Roger Banks. I kind of like Roger Banks, but, you know, he's been
he's
out
there. He's the chief researcher for the council. Has been for years.
Yeah.
Right.
So
okay.
My thing is, Mr. Edwards, I know that this is a golden opportunity, and yes, it can't be done in one meeting, but where's the outline? Where's the draft? When I go into the board room with some white folks, believe me, I got stacks of papers talking about directions, how we're going to do this, and how, you know, the approach.
Mm-hmm.
Today, and from what I can gather all along, nothing but a list of names on some paper.
Okay, and because I know there's a big battle going on with respect to the so-called presenters. I know that Gary Cunningham of the Northwest Area Foundation, former Judge Alexander, but specifically Louis King, who is involved with the Let's Train the Negroes to Death program, which, you know, we have to be, and it's something that Mr. First and the Star Tribune joined us, if you will, in confirming, is that, you know, black folk get trained real well, particularly up here. And it still does make any difference. That's the reason I raised the question to him about Mr. Mason, who I think is a significant feature in this story, a man who worked for 11 years. Now we find out that he got pushed out the door because of a disability, which, by the way, is against the law. Maybe the state human rights department, and if the firm is headquartered in the city of Minneapolis, maybe Velma Corvell and them will do something. But I'm looking at all this, and now you're telling me you had a planning meeting this morning, and the legislators are not there. Where's the leadership, the guidance?
Well, it's very hard. Here's what I think is what's going to happen.
Okay.
You got State Representative Bobby Joe Champion.
I cannot look at this guy without laughing.
I'm sorry, I had to play Richard Pryor. Anyway.
Okay.
You got Bobby Joe Champion. You got Jeff Hayden. Okay. This is nothing more than a positioning piece for the next election for both of them, okay? This has nothing.
Oh, they just got elected in November.
Yeah.
Well, they're planning that far ahead. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
They're planning that far ahead. See, the thing is, what they don't understand, the community is not buying in to this crap. I've gotten about 40 calls this week, half of them regarding Mr. First article, and the other half about this forum, this dog and pony show, as I call it. You know, until they have a plan. See, Bobby Joe Champion, state. Let me give him his respect. Representative Champion will be moderating this.
Okay.
And
Natalie Johnson Lee will be giving the summary, right?
The summary, yes. And so I'm wondering, why not you just sit Bobby Joe up there with his elected official counterparts and you have someone else to moderate it, number one, okay?
Right.
Number
two,
why everything that he's touched in North Minneapolis has been an absolute failure. If you ask him about jobs last year in January at the light rail with Northside Transportation Network.
That was premature discussion.
Premature, we're not talking about jobs.
Right.
you ask him, you know, he's more concerned about how his YouTube videos look than I shop, you know. And so it's a lot of things going on where those two state representatives, Hayden and Champion, are not telling the community. The community is not informed by its black legislators, okay? Yeah. God forbid, one more instance, you know, I received this email that was sent to State Representative Mike Beard, the chairman of the House Transportation and Finance Committee. It was from...
He's a Republican?
He's Republican. It was from the Metropolitan Council. It was from Susan Hay, from the chair of the Metropolitan Council.
Right.
She's telling this representative, this guy, that, hey, if you cut $120 million out of our budget, it's going to cost a $4 increase in fare.
A $4 increase?
$4 increase, which will bring the fares between $5.75 and $7 per ride. 50% to 60% lost in rides, okay? They're going to lay off approximately 550 drivers, cut 45% of regular scheduled bus routes. 240 peak rush hour bus trips will be cut, reducing metro mobility hours. Saturday and Sunday regular bus route, dial a ride programs might be eliminated.
Wow.
And so
how do quote unquote low income and poor people get back and forth to work? With your job, your employment should be just down the street from you, or I'd heard the rumor of that because I understand at the same time they were talking about significant cuts of the State Human Rights Department and others. And apparently some legislator picked up on the fact that if you take away also investigation / and enforcement, you never will deal with people such as ourselves and Mr. First and others have written about. And they went to waiving. Interesting enough, Mr. Allen, the state legislator pulled out Wednesday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune and Mr. First's story, front page above the fold, waving it, indicating that this is a prelude to a disaster. That's what this is. Why weren't we informed in the African American community that this was a plan afoot by our state legislature? Well, let me take that back. Maybe I'm being too harsh. Maybe we'll hear them pontificate on this on Wednesday with the governor.
Yeah, maybe not. The thing is,
well, let me ask you this: was it discussed at the planning meeting this afternoon?
No, it was not.
Oops.
No, it was not. Because this is an important piece. Because
that's right, because the legislators weren't there. I'm sorry.
Even if they were there, they wouldn't have been discussed because, you know, this thing has been sitting on the table, I guess, for some time. And what the meetings that we've been into, Mr. Edwards, and the meetings that I've been to, I sit there and I listen to Mr. Campion, Mr. Hayden, tell the community that the Republicans are taking this, the Republicans are doing this, you know, y'all need to come out now, y'all need to do this, you need to do that. And I said, now, wait a minute. Now, the Republicans just got in charge this year. And we can go 1 year back and we can talk about a budget of $30.8 billion. Okay?
Correct.
And what happened while the DFL, the Democrats, were in charge of the state capitol? I said,
well, let me just cut in for our domestic and international audiences. Just a year ago this week, there was a meeting at UROC, the third meeting of a series of meetings, in which our legislator, Representative Bobby Jo Champion, was asked a question again about jobs and economic opportunity. And he said again that was premature. And they were in the catbird seats at that time. The Democrats were the majority in both the House and the Senate. And a year ago to this week, we were being told it was premature to ask questions about employment opportunities on light rail and et cetera. Okay? So is there some pattern of madness with respect to this?
Yeah, I'm absolutely positive there is. Because, I mean, you have the Republicans right now, they are willing to come to the table in the community and give people factual information. This is making Champion and Hayden very nervous and some other DFL elected officials, okay, because they have to trim the fat from all this Democratic spending. So if the Democrats were in charge now, all this stuff would slide right through. The deficit would go through the roof, okay? So now they're trying to put handles on it. But the Republicans in Minnesota, from what I talked to many of them, We need a plan. Is there a plan? Can you guys come up, the community, come with a, we'll come to the community. We'll talk about light rail. We'll talk about why this needs to be cut. We'll talk about where the jobs can come from. Okay? I think, Mr. Edwards, that's more respectful than listening to State Representative Bobby Joe Champion telling us that the big new public works program for jobs is going to be the new stadium. My question to him, what stadium?
Yeah, by the way, for our domestic international listeners, is that ironically, and I've had some discussion with people in L.A. over the last week who already know the negotiations are going on to move the Vikings to Los Angeles.
Yes.
After the 2011 season, if there is a 2011 season, but it doesn't make any difference. And there is no bill before any committee or subcommittee in the Minnesota legislature for the building or the construction of a new stadium. And so I was puzzled a month and a half ago. I was in that same meeting at UROC when we were told this by Representatives Hayden and Champion. And I was hoping at that time that they were working on with their Republican colleagues, who they referred to as people they work across the aisle from, that they were crafting a bill that would be before the full House and the Senate. But, Mr. Allen, I have to tell you, and I'm well-versed on how that, you know, legislative process works. I mean, we only have about 5 weeks left in this legislative session, even if the governor was to, you know, order that the cloth be put over the clock. That's kind of a joke they tell. And we go into special session. But if you go into special session, it's kind of like Robert's Rules. There's only specific items that you can discuss, and normally they are budgetary items. And as far as legislative actions such as voting for a new stadium for the Minnesota Vikings would not be allowed under the parliamentary rules to be on the agenda.
Not at all.
And so you are absolutely on point, sir, with respect to the faking that was done to the community just a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, because there is no stadium to be built. But go ahead, sir.
Okay, we have a caller.
I'm sorry. Always cut in on the call. We must respect that. Go ahead.
A caller, you're live on point. Go ahead. Hello. Okay, he hung up. That's okay. That was actually Powers calling back. We probably touched some pushed some buttons there. But if you want to, you can definitely call back, Mr. Flowers. And again, anybody that wants to call in, the number is 877-572-4288. Again, the number is 877-572-4288. You're listening to On Point, broadcasting live from downtown Minneapolis in the McIntosh Studios.
Okay. Go ahead. Continue on. You had some line of thought at this point.
Yeah. I don't understand. You know, I spoke with this young lady named Pearl who worked with Impact Minnesota. And she's just livid. You know, and she's planning to go into this thing, this economic summit, Wednesday, March 30th at UROC on 2001 Plymouth Avenue North from 3:30 to 5. And if they don't let her ask a question, she's going to stand up and shout it out.
In front of the governor and his commissioners and powerful brokers. Now, as I understand it, there's a meeting Tuesday of the final planning meeting in which the presenters are going to be identified, and they will indicate what it is that they will talk about in their presentation. Now, we have to remember, for our domestic international audience, this is a 90-minute meeting. We're not talking about a three-hour session. This is a 90-minute meeting. Hopefully, the governor will be on time, that some crises will not come up at the state legislature. We're under some threats here. Not only legislatively, but environmentally, we've got the waters are rising, and we've got flood emergencies, and et cetera. And of course, the governor is called away to any number of different enclaves, and et cetera. So this is a 90-minute meeting. People need to understand. It'll take 4 minutes to 5 minutes to introduce all the dignitaries, and so that'll leave you basically with 85 minutes at best. So in an 85-minute meeting, what are we expected to – well, not us, because people like us wouldn't be invited. But what is expected to be done? How are they going to get these issues through, the presenters? Are they? I mean, is the time limit going to be put on them, Mr. Allen, to the best of your knowledge?
Best of my knowledge, there's going to be a time limit put on there on the people talking and then the Q&A session and Mr. Governor Dayton's stuff. But, you know, I mean, I like Governor Dayton, and this is no slight against him, but, like, in the last story I wrote, I told him to run. Get away from this. quick as possible. Because, you know, you have garbage in, you have garbage out. Okay?
Yes,
I have not seen any substantial documentation of a comprehensive a black persons of color job program or new business startup program. Because you know what? You can train people, Mr. Edwards, but if you don't have anywhere for them to go, Minnesota is host to 21 of the top of the Fortune 500 companies in the country. 21 of them. One of those people in that room have developed any cordial and diplomatic relationship with any of them companies
right.
in Minnesota to start. If they wanted to start a compensated work therapy program where
mm-hmm.
people that want to be in these different fields go out to these agencies and get paid for 20 hours a week, it's a start. It's something.
Let me ask you this question. Because, again, the importance of keeping the things moving and we are at the 45-minute mark, and we have another 40 minutes to go. I'm concerned with respect to the collapse of the nonprofits, because in the room you had a lot of nonprofits, obviously.
Yeah.
And what you're basically hinting at is the importance of getting for-profits involved who know how to deal and meet with these folks. I am greatly troubled by the continued collapse. Example, the Urban League, which on one hand has been posting propaganda that they're making a comeback and they've gotten a couple hundred thousand here, a couple hundred thousand there. They just lost a very significant program through the county, which dealt with people being able to come in, receive bus cards, other kinds of assistance, and et cetera, as it pertains to county programs. They lost that program. I think it's called the input program. They lost that program. They didn't get the application for the funding in on time.
Right.
Now, this comes at a time when the United Way has indicated quietly to powerful sources, which are now speaking about it, that another one of our agencies is about to be lost, that the African-American Family Services, the leadership of the board of that organization has made a decision to merge with 180 Degrees, and apparently they are forcing Lisa Jones, the very long-time and apparently very effective executive director, forcing her out, and she will be replaced by the white head of the 180 Degrees. Now, we're just losing our organizations left and right. I mean, what is it that we're going to be able to talk about as a foundation to do anything economically, job-wise, or other?
I mean, there's no foundation. I mean, it's hard for me to even answer that, honestly, Mr. Edwards, because
if
all these agencies are depending on government programs to hire lettered degree individuals that don't live in the community. Half of these people that run these nonprofits live nowhere in the inner city.
Okay.
And so with that said, you're wondering, I mean, I'm wondering, we're all wondering, I mean, why does $90 million go through North Minneapolis in 2010 from January to...
And please repeat that figure, Mr. Allen, so again that our listening audience can understand the kind of money that at least on paper is coming into this one of the most under-sieged and beleaguered communities economically and otherwise. And we just don't see the results. But what's that figure again, Mr. Allen?
$90
million.
From January 2010 to November, when I start counting, went into North Minneapolis last year, okay? Still, you have on March 23rd, Wednesday, the Star and Tribune puts out a story, our black-white jobless gap worse in the nation, okay?
Yeah, they sure do, and we had the pleasure of having the 38-year staff writer. In fact, Mr. First really was modest because I think, if I'm not mistaken, he is the most senior staff writer in the now at the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and that's a tough job to hang on at the Star because the Star has been doing its own cutting, if you will. But you're right. I mean, the headline is clear. It says worst in the nation. It has some figures. I mean, Minneapolis, when it comes to an adversarial and adverse situations and circumstances, continues to be number one. The first, as pertains to the gap, if you will, the first in making sure that African Americans are not hired, if you will. And when hired, and we go back to the study, the disparity study by the NERT group out of Austin, Texas, that African Americans here in this town on city projects, if they're able to get a job, if you will, they are required to work for 40% less than their white counterparts and 29.5% less than Hispanics and less 20-some percent less than Asians and about 14% less than Native Americans. I mean, understand that, my friends and our listening audience. In this town, if we do hire you and you're an African American, we require that you receive 40% less in salary and compensation. And by the way, on a radio program last night at the local black station here, a very professional sounding African American woman who is currently employed talked in terms of how she is being so mistreated on the job. She did not name the company or the entity, but that she not only is paid less than, and she's a manager, paid less than everyone in her category and discipline, but that there are other whites who have lesser educational attainment and et cetera that are paid more than her. And I'm just wondering, where's the enforcement? Because nothing, you know how I am, Mr. Allen, on this. You know, I'm a strong proponent of the fact that if you don't have a significant instrument of consequence, in other words, investigative agencies and et cetera, then these folks are going to continue to do what they're doing. And that is that they are committing economic, I've used this term and I continue to stand by it, they will continue to initiate economic rape of the African-American community. And that's what's happening, Mr. Allen. It is a sad commentary, you know.
Yeah, I agree. Now, Mr. Edwards, with about 33 minutes remaining in the show, again, I'm going to open up the phone lines, 877-572-4288. And this is kind of my favorite time of the show, Mr. Edwards, because we can go Mission Impossible, because there's some topics we got to talk about.
Let's go.
Mm-hmm. Favorite song. Mr. Edwards, The Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, please tell me they're not shredding files.
Yes, they are. In a copyrighted story in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, this week and the prior week, we have, as the columnists, conducted. We have been conducting a 5-year investigation of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department because of allegations of corruption and et cetera. In the last couple of years, we have obtained unequivocal evidence of serious violations of law, miscarriage of justice, and et cetera. And to your specific question, as we reported in our column this week, the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department has been involved in shredding the cases of individuals who have come to complain. And what's so egregious about this and so dangerous, and this is being orchestrated by persons of color, primarily African Americans, is that folks don't know that their cases are not being investigated. And what we pointed out in our column in the Spokesman Recorder this week is that letters are sent out to people indicating upon an in-depth investigation, we have determined no probable cause. They have changed that in the last number of weeks through the efforts of Michael Brown, who was an interim director and then was not reappointed or given the permanent position by Mayor R.T. Ryback, and then went over and became the chief investigator for Velmer Corvell in the state. And then when Velmer Corvell decided that Governor Tim Pawlenty was not going to attempt to run again, decided to get out, and in April of last year came over to take over the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, and then a couple months later, after pushing out the chief investigator for investigations, Mr. Ronald G. Brandon, who thought that he was talking to a person of of integrity and honesty when he explained and identified to Ms. Corbell that this practice was going on, he was forced out. In fact, he was forced all the way out the door. This is Mr. Brandon,
yeah.
And Michael Brown was then brought in to continue the journey. But to your question, yes, they're shredding documents. We're going with a story next week that identifies a specific situation that is well known, was well publicized jointly by us as a columnist and the Star Tribune with respect to a specific African American family and others who were put in such harm's way by Samuel Reed, the head of the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority, by actions that they took in concert with the police, that a member of the family had to be put in the witness protection program. So that's what we will be going with in our column next week. And, in fact, Norma, you asked this question. This is what we will be talking about tomorrow on our television program here in the Twin Cities.
Okay, we have a caller, Mr. Evans.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
You're live on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're live on the air. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, yeah. I was looking on my Facebook, and I seen that you guys were having a show going on. And I just want to comment and say that, you know, there are some jobs out here for African Americans, but we never get the jobs that are the high qualified paying jobs. You know, we're always on the bottom of the totem pole. And, you know, even though like for example, I have a 4-year degree and I'm still struggling to find a job that pays adequate. And when I say adequate, I mean something that's over $40,000 to $50,000, you know, but they're so to give you the jobs that pay, you know, $12 an hour, $17 an hour, anything below what could get you to $30,000 to $40,000 per year. And so my concern is when are we going to be given those opportunities to be in those positions that make $40,000 to $50,000 and to be successful and to, you know, help bring our families past the poverty line and those kinds of things. And I just don't really feel that I have those opportunities here in Minnesota.
All right.
Good.
All right. We'll try to answer that, sir. Thank you.
Good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Allen, that's an interesting, it's more an interesting question, and it's certainly appropriate not only for the times but for history. That young man sounds like he's probably in his late 20s and no more than maybe his early 30s, okay? He and others have to understand, and these are the conversations we've tried to have with others, even such as yourself, who are part of another era. Man, I got to tell you, in 1965, 66, 67, and 68, there was turmoil across this country, but there was turmoil right here in this city, and to the extent that in 1967, the National Guard had to be called in because young Negroes like myself and others, there were thousands of us, we're just sick and tired of going through what this young man just conveyed to us. And so, and just kind of condensing it, if you will, this same question that this young man just raised to us here on Point, Mr. Allen, in March of 2011, was what young men and young women such as him were raising in March and April of 1965 and 66, but particularly in 66 and 67 and 1968 on the occasion of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., raising this same question. I mean, in my life experience, it is not the first time. And what happened was I got a great education as a young man who thought that everything was revolving around us, if you will, let's say in 1966. When I had a group of older people who I now am in that particular category, who made us understand that this same question, man, was being raised in this town in the 1920s, okay? For over 87 years, the African-American community, the Negro community, the black community, however people want to label us, have been raising these questions about opportunity, the opportunity to enjoy the same rights that are accorded to the white population. So I just want that young man to know that, and I want to commend him because at some point in time, a old veteran like me thinks that we've lost our way and that maybe that passion and fire and brimstone is not there. But he and others, yourself even, Mr. Allen, need to know that, man, as far back as 1924, okay, that the Negro, if you will, 1966, the Negro, the black, was raising the same question, pleading for consideration, pleading for fairness, pleading for compassion, if you will. And it appears that, you know, it never happens, and then once in a while, a white newspaper will reflect on it, and black folk been talking about this for 100 years.
Yeah. It just ain't, there's something wrong with that altogether.
Give that number out again, Mr. Allen.
Okay. 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. You can give us a call, comments, questions, suggestions. We invite them. One thing, too, I'd like to talk about, Mr. Edwards, and let me just go up here because I'm in Studio B over here, and I'm on the computer. Last night, email came out to everyone on the listserv for the University of Minnesota UROC. They named Heidi Leslie Barras, if I pronounce that right, is named the Executive Director of the University of Minnesota Urban Outreach and et cetera, or UROC. And I think this is an appropriate time to congratulate her, but also ask her, you know, what are they going to do over at UROC to make sure people know what goes on inside the building?
Because UROC is supposed to be a research institute, if you will,
yes,
and a facility facilitating data, information, and et cetera. In fact, they should have been dealing with the very figures that some of us as black journalists and and most recently Mr. First and the Star Tribune reported on this past Wednesday, March 23rd. Correct?
Exactly.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I just decided now would be a really appropriate time as far as to publish the Broadband Technology Opportunity Program, where they received in excess, or the university received in excess of $3 million. And some really snazzy things are supposed to go on in the community to close digital divide that never happened, Mr. Edwards. So we're going to get to that this week and next week. And
$3 million. All right, then.
Yeah, $3 million close the digital divide. And, you know, we want to find out where that website is, where the brochures are, and what is the process. And a lot of people are asking me, I got a couple calls, I put something on Facebook about it. And people say, well, why are you so concerned? Why are you so worried about that? And I said, well, that's one of our main problems now. We don't understand, a lot of black folks don't understand government, don't care to understand government. But then again, this city has made sure that poverty is a distraction. So if you
decide
between gas and food, or food and then the next day, or what you're going to do, you know, the last thing on your mind is getting into the political process or understanding what's going on in the government. Because I'm telling you, our elected officials, you know, they're shedding no tears for no one here in the 5th Congressional District.
By the way, on that particular point, can we expect an emotional reflection and maybe some tears from Congressman Keith Ellison on the award-winning story in Wednesday's edition of the Star Tribune? Because we haven't heard from the congressman on anything that really affects the African-American community. I mean, I know he's been on his international agenda. And then, of course, he gave a very stirring performance before a House committee a couple weeks ago. But is there any tears from the congressman on the condition of his constituency in the 5th Congressional District? Does he have any tears for us?
I don't know, but you just made me grab. I got to stop that. I just grabbed my tissue because I had to wipe the corner of my eye because a little bit of water just rolled out. And we haven't had any compassion or anything, you know, for the anybody.
I was just wondering. I mean, I saw the performance by the congressman a couple of weeks ago, of course, a very emotional story. I had heard it before. In fact, I heard it within a couple of weeks of the bombing of the Twin Towers in 2001, September 11th. And it's good to see that he at least was displaying some attachment. But I was just wondering when he's going to have some attachment and tears for the people that put him in office.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's time for those people that put him in office to maybe reconsider who they put in office in 2012, next year. Already,
yeah, so, yeah. Oh, time goes fast when you're doing those 2-year terms. Yeah, time goes real fast. Now, when you're when you're in the mayor's office, like R.T. Ryback is, and you got four, and when you're in the Senate of the United States and you got six, you know, you got a little bit more leisure time, and you can play and party and travel and et cetera. But, I just had to say it. I mean, particularly after looking at and reading Mr. First's story almost every day being approached and asked for advice and suggestions from our people that are affecting or being affected by this, I just realized that I had not heard, you know, the kind of tears and compassion and chokedness in the voice, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In fact, I would have thought that he has that authority, I would have thought that the congressman would have way back in October when the report came out, which was, you know, the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis paid $500,000 for that report from the Austin, Texas group. You know, I thought that the congressman maybe would have had, he had won, he was safe again. I thought he would have had a public hearing here in the Twin Cities. You know, maybe like down at the public library, went into the big room there and asked city officials, that's a problem. He and the mayor are all of the same party, and a majority of the city council are of the same party. So I guess there's certain taboos that you don't ask. But still, I would have liked to have seen him ask the question on why this kind of disparity exists, if you will. But maybe in that the Star Tribune has done it. Maybe the congressman's office and staff will announce that there's going to be some kind of hearing by the little congressman sometime in the spring. You think so?
We'll
get that done?
Like I said, I was at that planning meeting this morning, and I was there with one of Congressman Ellison's staff people.
Oh, okay.
Who actually walked in the room and asked me what was I doing there.
I'm sorry. The United States Congressman staff person asked you what you were doing in a meeting in a local church?
Yes. And
that's kind of presumptuous.
Yeah, I just kind of.
In fact, that's almost arrogant.
Well, you know, that's why John Harrington beat her over there in St. Paul. Yeah, you don't come in.
Oh, I got you. I hear you.
Yeah.
Got you.
You don't come in.
Though I already knew what you were talking about, but yeah, you're right. But you know, hopefully, you know, that will happen, and quickly. Back to the Civil Rights Department, and you'd ask a specific question on the shredding. I'm also wondering why, because here in our town, by ordinance and law, the Civil Rights Commission, and certainly acting at the request of the director of the Civil Rights Department, could have held a public hearing and taken sworn testimony.
Yes,
they have that power as well as the office of the director. See, people tend to not remember, and I can well remember the joint request that came from you and I when the young African American last fall was tasered and beaten to death at the YMCA downtown Minneapolis. Velma Corbell has subpoena powers. She has power to subpoena, you know, to demand inquiry and explanation, et cetera. And, you know, I was kind of wondering why that hasn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Edwards, I mean, we spent like an hour, 2 hours on the phone, first of all, trying to get in touch with people from the YMCA. Then we sent a request down to Mrs. Corbell, Director Corbell. And I don't think she's responded to us to this day.
No, she's not. And, in fact, I understand in a conversation with the Civilian Review Authority individual who's claimed to fame is that he talks loud and laughs a lot, Sam Reed, that it would never happen. It would be a cold day in hell before she would get any response. And, of course, in the meanwhile, the family suffers. Though I understand that Mr. Smith, and this is different than Quincy Smith, whose family has initiated a lawsuit. I understand that Calvin Smith's family is working on a lawsuit against the city of Minneapolis. So at least that's good to hear. You know what I'm saying? But I just wonder why the Civil Rights Commission of our beloved city, Shangri-La here, and Velma Corbell, the powerful civil rights director who was in the paper, spokesman recorder this week, talking in terms of the wonderful things they're doing with getting contracts and monies for African-American people, which, of course, is totally untrue. I'm just wondering how come she doesn't exercise and utilize her subpoena authority and bring some of these businesses in. Because, see, one of the things that the Star Tribune could not deal with or allow to have, you know, printed per se, because you heard me ask the question of Mr. First, that I could understand the fact that he did not identify the armored car company.
Yeah.
You and I as journalists understand that. But Ms. Corvell could. Ms. Corvell, under color of law, important word. White folks always remind us the importance of that word. In fact, that's the word that's being used now as the war in Libya grows. But under color of law, she could have convened, asked the Civil Rights Commission to have convened a special meeting, public hearing, and we could have gotten an understanding of who it is that discriminates and doesn't hire black folk, and at the same time are getting all these contracts, you know, like from DOT and the Department of Labor and et cetera, both federal and state. You see, that's what a person who really is committed to the obligations and responsibilities of the job, that's what they would do, Mr. Allen. Would you not agree?
I would agree with you 100% on that, Mr. Allen.
That's right. That's right. Let's give that number one more time. We're down about, what, the last 14 minutes?
Yeah, 14, 15 minutes here. 15 minutes, actually. It's,
yeah. By the way, very quickly then, on the international scene, of course, last week, we got feedback of people. Appreciated the analysis and et cetera. Gaddafi is still in Tripoli, still there. The United States and her allies have been bombing now for seven straight days, if you will. They say they're not hitting any civilian targets. Okay, if you believe that, then you believe in the Christmas bunny. The casualties are really unknown. But here's something that's happening, and I think that we here at On Point should take a little bit of credit for it. All of a sudden, the problems in black Africa, particularly the Ivory Coast, and to a lesser degree, the eastern Congo, have become a talking point for both the general news networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, and the cable shows. And just about an hour before we came on the air, CNN does this in-depth, and they bring in a person who is with the United Nations Human Rights group to talk about the carnage. Do you know that over 1 million people have fled the Ivory Coast in the last week and a half?
Oh, wow.
Basically going into Liberia, some going into Ghana, some going to the northeast part of the country across the border. And so there's a lot of discussion about that. Of course, to those that have been killed, over 400 and some, almost 500 actually officially have been killed in the Ivory Coast since Christmas. I know that's not a great consolation to them, but that's what's happening. But back to Libya, as we reported here on Point last week, the issue in Libya, Don, is not, no one cares. I mean, you know, they don't care about the little brown people and black people of Libya. It's all about that black stuff called oil.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's happening right now in Zurich, Switzerland, and in Paris, is that it's one of the reasons the French suggested that this war now be run by the foreign ministers of eight or nine select countries. The Turks, who are a member of NATO, peaked what was going on and indicated that they would not sign on to the continued bombing of Lebanon. And by the way, Muammar Gaddafi is the target. Because you want to eliminate him, Don, in order to have a better handle on the legal questions of the contracts currently with oil companies doing business in Libya.
Yes.
You see, as we said on last week's program, you're talking in terms of, and you know, white America and white society also tells us the importance of contracts. And those contracts are technically and legally under the custody and control of Muammar Gaddafi. That's the reason that they set up a so-called satellite government in Benghazi.
Yeah.
They want control of that oil. Already about $250 billion of Libyan money, I'm talking about cash, has been seized by the United States and its European buddies. But there are legal consequences if, in fact, you can't get rid of Gaddafi, and also if you cannot get in and get control procedurally of the oil. So that's the big ticket item that is going on. President Barack Obama is coming under pressure. One other thing is an outgrowth of this situation. For the first time, Mr. Allen, we are hearing discussions by Republicans and Tea Party members of the issue of impeachment.
yes.
President Barack Obama for violating the War Powers Act. And we said on our radio program, our program to be aired tomorrow here in the Twin Cities, that the impeachment issue makes a lot of sense if you are a tactician or a strategist for the Tea Party, because if they can get articles of impeachment through the House and begin the process of a trial by the Senate, Barack Obama basically will not be able to campaign for the remainder of 2011 and definitely not in 2012. In fact, the strategy is to have the articles of impeachment in place by January of next year, which will basically just hamstring Barack Obama. And if he is convicted of impeachment, and you have to understand who controls the House, who will be what is called the managers of the trial, the Democrats have a very slim margin in the Senate to hold off the possibility of a motion and a vote at the conclusion of a trial for impeachment to preserve the presidency of Barack Obama. Now, people can say that this is far-fetching. Think about it. And it's a reason that Hannity and O'Reilly and them have been pushing it over the last 72 hours. Time to impeach the president. That's their thing. Serious, serious situation. Has terrible consequences for this country in the remainder of 2011 and going into 2012.
Mr. Edwards, we have a call.
Let's get it.
Go ahead. You're live on point. Mass is calling.
This is Lisa, founder of the Northside Information Exchange. How are you, gentlemen, today?
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How are you doing, Lisa?
I am doing wonderful. I have a little bit of input on the black-white jobless gap that they are talking about last Wednesday. That was also brought to the community as a WCCO good question, where they asked, why is it that we are the worst in the nation? And what was told to us was that it's basically because there's not enough black people in position to hire other black people, which sounds to me like a restatement of the problem. So I'm asking that everybody from the North Side and all black Minnesotans call into and send messages to WCCO asking them this question, for this question to be featured as a good question. Which organization's job is it to fix this ridiculous problem in Minnesota? And please include the many nonprofits in Minnesota while researching this answer. I'm quite sure that Minnesota's black population is not the least educated in the country, so the problem is systemic, and we ask that the system, who in the system will do something about it? And that's really my big question. If you are going to bring us a question that upsets our entire community, maybe you should bring us an answer that doesn't.
All right.
Whose job is this? So I'm asking for everybody in the community to contact WCCO and ask that good question. I will be posting it on our Northside Information Exchange Facebook for people to come and copy that if they need to.
And Lisa,
okay.
I'd also like to say that you can have people to join on Facebook, African American and Friends Against Mainstream Media, where WCCO.
I believe I'm already in there. Yep.
Yeah. Where WCCO for almost four quarters now has gotten an F minus in their coverage of the African American or Black community. So
I'll be happy to send that out to the community, Don, because I am very concerned that everything that comes up is. They have all kinds of problems, but nobody has any answers, and millions of people are being paid to watch out for our community, but none of these people seem to be paid to do anything about the things that are actually problems in our community. If the problem is we need more hiring managers, then somebody needs to get together with the many companies. And I'm also wondering, did affirmative action get repealed completely and I didn't notice?
No,
it seems
not.
To me that it did.
Well,
we need to go back to quotas. It's not working, whatever they're doing now.
Well, one thing, Lisa, I'm glad you called, but I'd just like to interject one more thing here before you get off, because I know you provide a lot of information to Twin Cities here, especially in North Minneapolis. But
is she still on? I thought I heard her click off.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, good. Go ahead, Don. Go ahead.
Here goes the thing that we have to look at. And I know I'm not telling you, Lisa or Mr. Edwards, anything new, but we have a lot black people, us, in the Twin Cities. In North Minneapolis especially, it's a cash crop. We have people doing things.
Agreed.
Doing things in the name of God and poor people. We're taking millions of dollars to come in and help. You know, what good would it be to solve poverty? The Urban League would go out of business. Northside Achievement Zone, Peace Foundation, Don Samuels, they wouldn't have a job. So
we know we should also request that all these nonprofits need to post on their websites the positive results they have gotten for the community. I can go to any of the many, many, I know there's 200 plus over in the north side just because you told me, Don Allen.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize there were that many nonprofits. And truthfully, that's probably the only jobs that black people do hold in Minnesota for the majority is these nonprofits. So I don't want them to go out of business. But I do want to know, what is your business and are you handling it? Because if you were, there's no way I can believe the numbers that the mainstream media is feeding at me.
But see, Lisa, one thing on that real quick here is, yeah, we want the nonprofits to go out of business, because if they go out of business, what that means is that the brothers like maybe a Sean Lewis or these other guys that work at these nonprofits will be pushed into business to use their degrees. Have those guys that are working at these nonprofits got degrees in business management, administration, rocket scientists, and they're working at nonprofits. Okay, so if you had the proper, if General Mills would take some of their money and put a plant in the middle of North Minneapolis that hired 400 or 500 people, okay, that would eliminate about 60 nonprofits right there. Because if they hired from that zip code, those two zip codes, 05 and 11, okay, there's a strategic move that has to go on here to fix North Minneapolis. If we get Don Samuels out of office and put some politician in there that would make North Minneapolis a fair tax zone, okay, which means that if you work and live in North Minneapolis, you don't pay taxes out of your paycheck or the money you earn, but you pay taxes on what you buy. Okay, right now, all that money, that $90 million plus, that 2010 throughout the year, is going into North Minneapolis and is leaving on payday. It's going to Woodbury, China.
Guaranteed. So, and even the shop owners that Don Samuels said he wanted to bring in from the suburbs, there's a video on YouTube years ago where he thought that everybody who owned a business on Broadway must be drug dealers, and so he wanted to bring in people from the suburbs. I mean, how do you represent us with that kind of statement? That's just ridiculous. That's for just part of gentrification, which I've already said over and over again.
Yeah.
It's one of my big pet peeves is that you want to exclude us and remove us instead of include us, and that's the big problem I have with all of the programs going on currently in North Minneapolis. And
okay.
That's really
okay.
The city that's doing that.
Thank you so much, gentlemen,
for doing such a great job and a great show today.
Hey,
all right, thank you. Very quickly, what do we have, about 3 minutes, Mr. Allen, to the caller's question. One of the areas that, and one of the groups that have to not only be asked that question but be required to respond, or we'll be meeting Wednesday, and that is our elected political leaders, led by the Chief Executive Officer of the state, the Honorable Governor Mark Dayton. And I hope that there are enough people there who will raise the questions. And starting on Tuesday, I hope that working through people like Mr. Flowers and Troy Parker and others, that they will be able to go into the meeting Tuesday and indicate that they're under pressure from a constituent base who are saying, these are the kind of questions we want asked. We don't want these powder puff, patty pat questions to be asked to make the governor look good and to make, quote unquote, our elected political officials. So to her question, we've already got a captive situation, not necessarily a captive audience, but a captive situation. We've got the governor, chief executive of the state coming in, and some of these questions in the last 2 minutes of this program, Mr. Allen, she was asked of the governor, and I repeat it again, it's a question that's been asked, and it's a question that must be answered during the time that you're there. We don't need you to do, we'll get back to you.
Yeah,
because, by the way, that's become a modus operandi in the interest against the black community's interest, and that is, we'll get back to you, Don.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't work like that. All right, looks like we're getting ready to wrap it, Mr. Allen. First of all, we want to thank always our listening audience, and particularly those that pick up that phone or pick up that communication device and certainly ask the question.
Yes, we do. We'd like to thank Star Tribune's Randy First for joining us today. You've been listening to On Point with your hosts, Don Allen and Mr. Ron Edwards. If you live in Minneapolis proper, you have Comcast, go to Channel 17 tomorrow, Sunday, the 27th of March at 5 p.m. and tune into Black Focus. And your topic again?
My topic again will be the policy. Of course, we'll be dealing with the international problems, talking about the impeachment of President Barack Obama, but we also will be talking about the shredding that has been going on inside the Civil Rights Department under Velma Corvell and prior to that, Michael Jordan. Hey, thank you. Good program, Don.
Thank you, thank you. And don't forget to read the Independent Business News Network and the Minneapolis Story, theminneapolisstory.com, and the Independent Business News Network. We'll be back next week at 4 p.m. Thanks for listening. And to close us out, we'll bring the Honorable James Brown.
All right.